I'm Michael, and welcome to Beyond the Screenplay. Today, we are talking about The Dark Knight Rises, the 2012 film directed by Christopher Nolan, screenplay by Jonathan Nolan and Christopher Nolan. I'm joined by part of the Lessons from the Screenplay team, Brian Bittner.
Hello.
And Alex Calleros.
Hi.
As we said last time, Trisha, unfortunately, could not be here, which is sad because she has thoughts about this movie. So we called in a favor from our friend Sage Hayden of the YouTube channel Just Right. Sage, welcome to the show.
Michael, you're really lucky I like you, because...
Because we don't call you for Batman Begins.
Oh, oh boy, was I never going to watch this movie again.
Off to a good start.
Yeah. Apologies. But we'll try to make it worth it. So Sage has been on our show before. We, in our Game of Thrones episode, Sage, Alt-Shift-X, Alex and I had fun talking about Game of Thrones. It was a very cathartic experience.
I'm sensing a pattern in when we right. ask Sage to join us.
I was just thinking that. I'm only allowed to discuss bad media.
we'll have to work on that moving forward. But of course, Sage has a YouTube channel, Just Write, W-R-I-T-E. And I often describe our channels as like sister channels because your channel is also about writing and storytelling and looking at film, but also literature and TV shows and video games. Sage recently did an episode on The Last of Us Part 2 that was really, really good. Mm-hmm. That was also a very cathartic watch for me. So definitely check out Sage's channel, Just Write. If you like Lessons from the Screenplay and you like Beyond the Screenplay, you will definitely like Just Right. And so it's kind of fortuitous. It's unfortunate that it's The Dark Knight Rises in some ways. But Sage, you've made several videos about Batman. One was What Writers Should Learn from Batman Begins. That was kind of looking at the structure of Batman Begins. And then a two-part video series on what kind of a hero Batman is. And that was like looking at six different archetypes of heroes and how they all kind of combine to make Batman. And it's really interesting. So there's lots of videos for you to watch. But I'm curious, going into The Dark Knight Rises, what was your experience of the film? Like, what was the buildup? What were your expectations? Were you excited about it? Were you worried about it? What was it like going into The Dark Knight Rises and then walking out of the theater for you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, my expectations were through the roof. I was huge, huge fan of the previous two films, as I feel like the entire world was at the time. It was like a phenomenon. I was actually in Quebec when I saw the movie. So it was fun to see it with a group of people that I wouldn't otherwise have seen a movie with. Afterwards, I remember really like enjoying it the first time I saw it and thinking like, wow, you know, like we have a really good trilogy here, you know, all three films of some quality. And oh, I'm already being too harsh on it by phrasing it that way.
We got off to a pretty harsh start here.
It's all right. I mean, I think, you know, It's not the most celebrated of Christopher Nolan's films. I think we can acknowledge that. Yes.
Had high expectations for it. And I feel like as the years have gone by, it's diminished. And like this year, it is almost like impossible to watch. like, I mean, this movie ends with like the good guy cops fighting the rebel terrorists in the streets. Like,
everyone has to stay indoors.
Yeah,
you're right.
Yeah,
it's like a kind of a quarantine going on.
Right. Yeah, there's no crowds anywhere. There are only cops and criminals in the streets. it is. Yeah, it's like really, it's really tough to watch it today.
Yeah, it is. It is interesting. It hasn't aged super duper well. But I remember it being kind of, you know, at the time, I think it was sort of drawing on the politics of, you know, Occupy Wall Street and like the 1%, like some of that was in there. And I remember thinking like, oh, that's cool that you're like kind of trying to deal with those things. Yeah, Brian, I'm curious for you, what were your expectations going into the movie?
My expectations were high. You know, the same. I was just kind of like, it's one of those things where you're like, if the third movie can be as much better than the first movie as the sequel is, like, holy shit, like we're off, you know, to the races here. And I, you know, I'll say I've never not had a good time watching this movie. Like, I do think it's just, I there's a lot of fun stuff in here. There's a lot of really impressive Nolan stuff here. And I also think it's a pretty disappointing movie. but I also think there are threads in this movie that make it a satisfying closure to the trilogy, even if overall I think there's sort of like broad issues from a like writing standpoint and storytelling standpoint. I do sort of watch the last 10 minutes of the movie and kind of like go like, oh, we went on this like fun, you know, what, 5-6 year ride together, and now it's coming to a close. And, you know, so I appreciate a lot about the movie and I do have a good time watching it, but it does always leave a sort of sour taste in my mouth when, if I watch all three in a row, where I'm just like, ah, yeah, we kind of ended. This is where we're ending.
Yeah. Cool. Alex, what about you? Why don't we finish going around?
I had huge expectations. Of course, I was really obsessed with like the final trailer because I think like Hans Zimmer did original score for it, and they like do the trailer thing where they have Batman saying like, not everything, not yet, like right before like the Zimmer music drops.
And oh, it's, that's
like,
the best part of the whole movie.
Yeah, like on July 20th. Yeah, it's like, so I definitely got myself just like into hype trailer mode, where it's like, okay, maybe it's going to be great. But I had to build back up to that place after seeing the like preview in IMAX, because I think it was before Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. So they did the thing where they premiered the first like 5 minutes of the film in IMAX before IMAX screenings of that Mission Impossible movie. And so, of course, I was so down and so excited because they had done a similar thing with The Dark Knight, where they showed the opening Joker bank heist sequence.
Before I Am Legend.
Right. And so it was like, you know, I remember our friend Ryan said he like stood up and like did give a standing ovation in the IMAX theater after seeing that like opening scene in IMAX.
For The Dark Knight.
For The Dark Knight. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Before I Am Legend. Anyway, so it's like, okay, cool. I'm ready for that experience for this movie. And it was like, what is this? Like, where are they? Like, they're on a plane and I don't understand anything that anybody's saying, but especially Bane, not a single word could be understood. Not a single word. And they actually changed it for the finished film, I noticed. Like, he's slightly more clear in the finished film version of the opening sequence.
He actually redubbed his lines. Like, if you listen to the two side by side, it's like he has a different delivery. And I do think it's funny. Sorry, I'll let you finish. But like, I think it's funny that they not only had him redo it, they play it like he's inside your ear. Like, it's not just like, oh, we made it clear. It's like, we made it as clear as possible. So you just hear this like, perhaps he's wondering why you'd shoot him on before throwing him out of a plane. And you're like, wow, this sounds like he's narrating. Like, he's just like, it's like, I remember wondering why he would shoot him on. Like, it's like telling you the story later, like Stand By Me style.
We have like wireless earbuds. A feed from Bane. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, that was just kind of a good, just a kind of mystifying like sneak preview where like I didn't even know like what just happened or what to make of it or how that was a Batman movie. So there was this unsettled feeling I had of like, oh shoot, like this, something's wrong here. This doesn't feel right. And then, so I was like really concerned. And then those like final trailers came out and it looked like a Batman movie again and it had all the things. And so I was back on board and really excited. And similar to Brian, when I first saw it in theaters, I did overall, because of the way it concludes, because it has some of those epic moments like him climbing out of the pit to that music, I got like the movie experience I wanted, but I also just like was unclear on like what even was that story and like what,
right,
like, what was Bane's plan and like what even happened there and what are the mechanics of all this.
Try to summarize this movie,
like, yeah.
right
It's like if you ask someone what the movie is, they would say like, oh, it's about Gotham being under siege by Bane, and that doesn't happen until an hour and 40 minutes into this movie. And I just think it's really interesting to track. I there's like a trilogy of trilogies that Nolan is doing here, where you have Batman Begins and The Prestige, which feel like, okay, this guy is here. He's making these really solid Hollywood films. And then there's Dark Knight and Inception, which is like, holy crap. Like, this guy is like,
peak.
Right. Like, pushing the envelope, just doing these like huge things. And then there's Dark Knight Rises and Interstellar, which just feel like so ambitious and so huge, but also so convoluted and so messy.
Bloated.
Yeah. Bloated. Weirdly, I feel like sometimes these long movies, I'm like, I don't want them to be shorter. I want them to be longer, but like two movies or a series or something like that. Like, I like all these stories you're exploring here. You're just not actually exploring them. You're like, here's this character, here's this thing, here's this idea. And it's just like, oh, good God. I just rewatched Godfather 3 recently, and it sort of feels like a similar thing where it's like, we're trying to be a sequel to these previous two movies, but we're also introducing like new characters and new ideas. So now it's like you have all of these things that this movie's trying to track, and some threads just never get closed. They just are sort of there. And it's like, that was an interesting scene that like never gets dealt with again. And yeah, it's just, I like long movies when they're well done, and I don't like long movies when they just feel like they're all over the place.
My experience going into it, I think, was the opposite, where like I had really, really low expectations because once you make a movie like The Dark Knight that is lightning in a bottle that you could never do again, and then, you know, of course, Heath Ledger, like, I was aware that it was impossible to make another movie that was going to be as good as The Dark Knight. And so my first reaction when they started talking about Dark Knight Rises and it's coming, I was like, no, don't do it. Just don't. Just let us have The Dark Knight.
Just let it be.
Don't need a third. Mm. It's not going to be as good. And then going into the actual theater, I had my expectations low, and I was just ready to give Christopher Nolan like the benefit of the doubt. Because what do you do? What do you do after The Dark Knight when you accidentally, like, you tried to make a good movie, but you ended up making the best movie ever. And now people are asking you to do it again. Like, that's an impossible situation.
See, I feel like I'm like Charlie Brown with my expectations for these movies. Because, like, this is the third, that trilogy was like the third time in a decade where a superhero trilogy came up with a great first installment, and then a much better second installment, and then just you know, totally falls apart in the third.
Right. You have like goth Bruce Wayne dancing through the streets in this one. It just feels like a little out of place.
Yeah. And X-Men, you know.
X-Men.
Yeah. Oh, I thought you were talking about Spider-Man.
And Spider-Man.
That works too.
Both of them.
Yeah. I mean, but like X-Men is the only one where there's a pretty like clear reason. Like the third movie wasn't made by the person who made the first two, as opposed to Spider-Man and Dark Knight, where it's just like you had the same people there and they just did a different thing. They went a different way. I do have a question. How would we feel about this movie if Dark Knight never existed and this were the sequel to Batman Begins?
I was thinking about that watching this, where it's like, I think this movie is judged harsher because it's the sequel to The Dark Knight. Mm-hmm. And I think if this was just the second Batman movie, I think it would be really impressive. I don't know that it would be like a great movie.
It wouldn't be any better either than it is as a movie, but it wouldn't be held in the same sort of
There wouldn't be a disappointment happening.
Right.
It's kind of my thought.
That's fair. Yeah.
Well, and a thing that I like about it, while The Dark Knight is kind of separate from Batman Begins in some ways, like you could just watch The Dark Knight. You don't really need to like have seen Batman Begins. They tried to reconnect it to Batman Begins, and I think that gives it some strength in some ways, and in other ways is, you know, subtracts from it. But I do like that they kind of evolve the theme of fear. And as we talked about in Batman Begins, they're very upfront about like this movie is about fear, which you also pointed out in your video. It was fun to watch that Sage and just show all the examples.
The montage.
It's
literally every other line in that movie.
This is right. I do think, Alex, you kind of mentioned it, that Bruce Wayne having to escape from the hole, that prison, is a really cool sequence. And one of my favorite sequences from the trilogy, and it is this evolution of this idea of fear where Bruce has overcome fear so that he's not afraid to die anymore. And he has to learn to want to live. And that will give him the strength to continue. And that's a really cool.
Yeah, that's clever.
Powerful idea. Yeah. And I like that, you know, in your videos, Sage, you talk about this being like a resurrection movie for Bruce Wayne. And I think that's a really cool idea. And I hadn't really thought about it in those terms, but I think that's the parts that are special. That's why it's special.
Well, this is like a double resurrection movie, which is, I think, part of the problem with the structure of the film is that it tries like Batman. He becomes Batman in the first hour, and then he gets hit down into the well. And now he has to become Batman again, right bringing ideas in from like The Dark Knight, right, or The Dark Knight Returns, the comic book story, and Nightfall, the story where Bane snaps Batman's back,
right,
and No Man's Land, right? Like you've got all of these different comic book inspirations for this movie that like just is just too much, right? And it was almost too much back in The Dark Knight when they were doing like lifting stuff from like the Long Halloween and you know, a lot of other Batman stories as well. But yeah, here I just feel like it's, if you want to fix the film, you have to tinker with the structure, because that's the core problem on this one, I think.
Well, it just feels like, and he often does this, but Nolan bit off more than he could chew with this one. You know, it's just, there's just too much. Like, it's interesting when I watch it, the first half of the movie, a lot of that I find really fun. Like, actually, I remember being in the theater watching it for the first time and kind of being delighted by how much fun I was having in a way that was different from The Dark Knight, you know, where there is some like lightheartedness with Anne Hathaway as Catwoman. And there's some playfulness that was kind of missing from The Dark Knight, and it's just grave seriousness. I mean, the Joker is playful in his own way, but it's a very twisted, dark playfulness. So I actually was enjoying the tone and kind of the less self-serious vibe in the first half, and then it makes that turn at the midpoint and becomes so self-serious and so like kind of weird and political, and making a comment about, like, I guess like socialism is bad, or I don't know what it's trying to say exactly. It was like this weird experience of like, there was like one movie in here in the first half that I was really enjoying as like, let's just have fun with this final movie, and this other movie in the second half that was trying to be really like almost academic and like, you know, we've convened a court to like, you know, judge you. Yeah. It was like, I feel like you're trying to like tell me things. What are you trying to tell me right here, Nolan? There's two different movies here, and one of them I was really enjoying, and one of them I feel very ambivalent about.
Yeah, you talked about Dark Knight, how you start to get like fatigued towards the end. And I feel like this movie is that times two, where rewatching it, like I rewatched it 2-3 weeks ago, and then I like sort of had it on today, and like even having just recently watched it, there were scenes in the third act where I'm like, what is this scene? I don't even remember, who's this guy? Like, just like stuff that was just like, also there's like Joseph Gordon-Levitt down in the thing, and there's like a guy who just showed up who's like holding a gun to his head, and like, and there's a whole like outdoor scene with the bat wing and how it doesn't have autopilot. And I'm just like, good God, like there's so many exchanges between like every pairing of two characters in this movie. Like there's some scene somewhere where they just like exchange a few lines. And then, yeah.
There's got to be at least 300 scenes in this movie.
Right.
Right. No kidding.
Yeah. This episode of Beyond the Screenplay is sponsored by Mubi, the curated streaming service that premieres a new film every day. Something that bothers me about film culture is how so much attention gets paid to new, shiny, expensive American movies, leaving so little room for the classics, indie movies, and films from other countries. That's what I appreciate about Mubi. Each film is hand-picked, there's no algorithm, and it's an amazingly eclectic selection of films from all over the world and from every time period, from old classics to new releases. So if you ever wanted to step outside your particular bubble of film knowledge, Mubi is the perfect place to get started. And you can do so today by heading to Mubi.com/beyondthescreenplay to get 30 days for free. That's Mubi.com/beyondthescreenplay. Thanks to Mubi for sponsoring our show. Back to the episode.
You're talking about the fun of the movie, and I don't even know that like the whole first half is fun, because it starts off, and this was kind of a really interesting choice, I thought, where it's like, it's not picking up shortly after The Dark Knight. It's like 8 years have passed and Bruce Wayne has become a shut-in. And so you're also dropped into a Gotham that you don't recognize, which is kind of interesting. It's
the word you're looking for is Pittsburgh.
Well, it's like Pittsburgh / Los Angeles, which was also really distracting. Like,
but New York, anytime they pull out and show you an aerial shot.
And anytime Joseph Gordon-Levitt's on screen.
Right.
Well, that's part of like the kind of Nolan dedication to like anti-CGI. The downside of that is he's just so stubborn. He's just showing us a bunch of different actual cities instead of like a partially CGI'd up like Gotham. Mm-hmm.
And didn't they already have one? Like in Batman Begins, I'm pretty sure there's a shot that feels like a CGI city that they could just be using.
Right? They definitely did it in Batman Begins, which is the only movie that really feels like it's a comic book city. Like every other movie, it's like, oh, this is just like a hodgepodge of just literal parts of actual cities I recognize. And it's like, it's okay, use a little CGI, just enhance it, you know, like use a piece of Chicago and show us some Gotham.
I mean, there are wide shots where they do that, but it's when you're actually in the movie and the scenes are happening, it's very clearly like, this part is in LA, this part is in like,
right.
And that is kind of distracting. This is kind of a random trivia thing, but Alex and I, back when we were making our year of short films that we've talked about a little bit, our DP lived in downtown Los Angeles, and right around like the corner from where his like studio was this big empty lot. And then one day there was like 100 cop cars parked in this big empty lot. And we're like, what the hell is this? And so like it's pitch black at night. It's like not the nice part of downtown LA. And so we go and like we investigate and look, you know, all these cars are parked behind like this chain link fence. And if you look closely, all the cop cars say Gotham City Police Department on it. And so there's that big car chase that happens and it's shot in LA. And they actually had 100 cop cars made for that. And it was cool to like see the parking lot where they kept them in between shoots.
You just told us last week how you were in Chicago when they were shooting Dark Knight.
He's you everywhere.
Just, were you just stalking all of the noise?
Right. Were you like Grateful Dead, like touring along?
Maybe Christopher Nolan's following me.
It's more likely.
Pittsburgh famously has all those bridges, so it's kind of cool they use that. And it makes sense continuity-wise because Batman Begins was like, we're blown up all the bridges so that people can't get out of the city. The weird thing about this movie, though, and part of the reason they had to have new shots, external shots, is like the whole movie is daytime. Like it's a Batman movie that takes place in like the mid-afternoon. And I feel like Batman Begins is like all night. And then Dark Knight is kind of a cool blend between the two where it's sort of like it's like a nice flow. And then like the entire last half of this movie is just all daylight, which just for a Batman movie in general feels weird, but especially for like the finale to this trilogy to have like Batman running around, like getting a suntan just is weird.
Yeah, it always feels like it's 11 a.m.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And like 11 a.m. is brunch.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. There is definitely like a brunchy vibe to like the weather. Like it seems just like a nice, like sunny winter day all the time. Yeah. You know, yeah.
Someone bring me some cantaloupe.
And I feel like if had they shot it at night for the like the last hour of the movie, I feel like should be at night. Mm-hmm, and I feel like that would make up for the fact that I think they ran out of the budget for extras because there's no like people walking around at all. Right. Like it feels like there's like 200 people in the city who are having a skirmish like mm-hmm. right for the whole last hour. So,
right.
Yeah. It's interesting because it's like if you're going to have a plot that ends with like a city like descending into chaos or to kind of being under mob rule or whatever they were trying to do there, you kind of want to see like everybody out in the street. You want to see like the population like taking over the city. And we never really see that in a big way. You just see these kind of quick montages of like, oh, we've ransacked the rich person's house. But I never got a sense of what was actually happening in Gotham, like what actually happened.
Well, there's that very weird montage, and this is kind of getting at the structure thing that you were talking about, Sage, where it's like, you know, Bane goes outside the prison and he has his big speech about, you know, Gotham is yours, and like shoots the hole in the prison. But while he's talking, and I remember thinking in the theater, I'm very confused about the timeline because he's speaking about things that are going to happen, and then they're showing cuts to like riots and people being pulled out of their penthouses and things. And it's a little unclear at first for me anyway. Is this the future? Like, is this happening now? Because it keeps cutting back to Bane. But then once we do cut to the future and this has happened, like you guys are saying, the streets are empty. Like there isn't that sign of that chaos except in, you know, the courthouse where the Scarecrow is holding court or whatever. Scarecrow's court.
The time problems on this movie are just infinite. Like the 5 month bomb clock, like they remind us about, oh, it's 3 months away, and then like two scenes later it's like it's 23 days away.
It's like the cops have been without food for 3 months. Like what, when? Oh, okay.
Yeah,
that's
well they've been like getting emergency, like Bane is allowing them to like lower emergency food supplies down into the sewers for the cops for the past 5 months, but not allowing the cops to leave. Like what really goes wrong in the second half is they try to set up this pretty bizarre convoluted situation, which to like maintain it and to have it like keep all the pieces in place you want for the finale, you have to like jump through a lot of hoops to like maintain the situation as it is for the finale you want. So it's like we got to keep the police off the streets, but also still alive, but also like this, but also this. And it's like, this doesn't make any sense anymore. Like, I don't, like, what is the reality of this film?
Can I give my like one quick fix to this, to the this movie structure?
Please,
please.
You need to structure it like a parallel universe story. So there's like a lot of DC stories where, you know, you start off in one reality and then, you know, the Flash gets tossed into a different reality, right? But you're following him the whole time, right? So when he arrives in that new reality, it's a complete surprise to him. And we learn what everything, how everything is different through him, right? In this movie, if you have the scene where, you know, Batman gets his back broken, he gets tossed in the well, and if we just stay with him the whole time through the well and then just follow him to Gotham, and he just arrives in Gotham and and learns about how everything has changed, then you don't have the hour where Batman isn't in the movie at all and you're just following the secondary characters. You don't have any of these time issues or, you know, how is this happening? How is this coming together so quickly? Just avoid all of that and just have it be like a clean, okay, now you're back in Gotham and here's the situation. It's completely different. You need to solve it, Batman.
I really like that.
That's a great suggestion. That would fix a lot of the problems I have with this film. If you just skip over that middle section where it's all about the mechanics and the politics and the rigmarole with like the agents getting in and then getting hung by the bridge. Like all these new characters that are just disposed of, like too many characters.
That kind of gets at something I always remember from one of the special features of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, Fincher's version, as they're talking about editing and how the first time they were having trouble conveying to the audience all the like little parts of the mystery required to be putting it together. And so they were trying to edit it like even more slowly so you could be like, okay, see audience, this person was this person then, but then they grew up to be that person and they were in this city at that time and that wasn't working either. And so ultimately they were like, just go through it as quickly as possible. Like the audience doesn't actually need to know these details. Like they're invested in the character story at this point. So sometimes speeding through it or not giving people the exposition to follow every beat is allows you to focus on the things that people do care about. And I feel like that's what your suggested fix does, Sage, where it's like, we don't need to know that they decided to send the police down, thousands of them, into the sewer for a training exercise. Like, the less we know, the more we will believe what's happening.
Yeah, and it's kind of going against the, you know, the number one rule of writing, show, don't tell, right? I'm literally saying, don't show us all that. Tell us all of that later when Batman learns it, right? Because then you don't have to re-explain it to, like, 100 times anyway. I feel like they explained that the bomb will go boom like when the time goes out like 8 different times.
Right. Well, because they're always like telling us how much time we have. They're always like, well, it's going to be 39 hours. Like, okay, cool. We got it.
Yeah. Like the ticking timer thing, I think when it's that specific and they know it 5 months out, like I can't.
The bomb is the worst part of this things. Movie.
It's so bad.
It's the worst part. All pretense of like this movie being like elevated with its political themes just goes out the window when it's like, and I have a bomb that'll explode everything. You know, like it's
right.
It's nonsense.
Yeah, it's something Michael talked about in the Dark Knight podcast. Was like it was refreshing in the mid to late aughts to not have the movie where it was like, then the guy shows up and he has the giant laser that's going to kill everybody or whatever. Usually it's like the bomb. Lo and behold, Dark Knight Rises is like, there's a bomb and it's like clean energy, but like somebody knows how to do a thing and they know where a thing is so they can change it. So now it's a bomb and like there's a trigger and someone has it and football. And it's just like,
okay, and the football scene. I hate it so much. I hate it.
I like that it's like the most American thing, so it's like easily recognizable as like a good way to like terrorize a community. I like that it's the Gotham Rogues, which is just a very cute little nod, but I do hate that it's like actually Hines Ward wearing like Steelers colors running across the field, like not realizing the entire field is blowing up behind him until the last second. He's like, I just made a touchdown, wait a minute, everyone's dead. Like, that's weird. But like the whole concept of being like, let's set like a Batman villain on a football field, I'm like, that's actually pretty cool. I like that.
I just, I know something about it just aesthetically like rubbed me the wrong way. Just like that visual and like doing the Star Spangled Banner sung by the little boy like over a montage of like
the police. Lovely, lovely voice.
Yeah, the police into the sewers.
The Americana of this movie is like really on the nose. Like at the end when there's like tattered American, like after they've won, there's like tattered American flags and it's like you know, America, we made it through socialism. You know, we survived. You know?
Yeah, this movie is so confusing politically because, like, they have like legitimate like critique in the beginning of like grotesque income inequality. They have a whole scene at this like charity fundraiser. Anne Hathaway is like giving the badass speech about like, you have no idea what's coming. Like, I'm adaptable, but rich people aren't. If things go south, you're not going to know what to do with yourselves.
Thomas, like Bruce Wayne's dad from Joker, is like the guy at the fundraiser who's like, anybody see Bruce Wayne at one of these things? Like, it's the same actor, which is just really confusing. That's
funny. I didn't notice that.
Both of those movies are movies where we put the complaints about income inequality in the mouth of a cartoonish Batman villain.
but even in like, yeah, even Joker, the way it like handled it seemed more interesting to me than the way this movie handled it, because it seemed to eventually land on like, don't worry about income inequality, because if you try to address it, that is the actual danger, and like the only like the alternative to income inequality is this horrific, even more horrific thing that will be saved only by like mass police force like putting down the threat. So it was like what was Christopher Nolan's intended message? Was it that, like, because it was coming on the heels of this, yeah, this Occupy Wall Street moment, and I don't know, Christopher Nolan strikes me as someone who like would politically like have some sympathy for like people saying income inequality is grotesque and is like ruining our country in a lot of ways. And so it's interesting to see like this is what he did with that moment. What were you trying to do with that moment, Nolan?
Yeah, I don't know. He made the revolutionaries into terrorists, and then made the Wall Street stockbrokers the innocent victims of a robbery. In my least favorite scene is that scene where Bane robs Wall Street. Mm-hmm. Like that's the one that I just like I'm like red hot watching it. Like when the stockbroker is explaining to the cop, like, that's everyone's money.
Yeah. You know? Oh, right. Yeah. Like everybody who's invested in the stock market.
Yeah.
I feel like for me, it feels more like these ideas are raised, but then just kind of left behind. Mm-hmm. Like,
right.
To me, I don't even kind of read what happens afterwards as continuing that commentary. And maybe because just the mechanics of the plot get in the way of any like memory of message or theme. And I feel like that adds to this like muddiness thing, because there is this very strong moment, like you were talking about, Alex, with Anne Hathaway, and like there's a storm coming, and like all the stuff that's like really cool and made for a cool voiceover in the trailer.
The trailers,
man.
Storm
coming, Mr. Wayne.
But yeah, then it doesn't go anywhere. And I think more it's just it goes somewhere that's completely confusing and you lose track of what's trying to be said about it. So yeah, I feel like on that front, it definitely drops the ball.
Yeah, it just always feels like the heroes are fighting for the thing that the movie doesn't actually want them to be fighting for. Like, because they're trying to get back to the status quo, but the movie also knows the status quo is bad.
Right.
So it's...
Well, and it's also weird that Bane's plan is this kind of like trickery where it's like fake giving people the city back to the people, but it's only to give them hope. So that then they'll be really sad when they die.
All of that is just to torture billionaire Bruce Wayne while he's in a hole, because he let Liam Neeson die in the first movie.
Right. And it's literally just an extended like psychological torture for Bruce Wayne, but it involves all these mechanics and like organization and plotting. It does not make sense.
Like watching Miranda in this movie when she has like when they have her and other people captured, where I'm like, why is she now not just revealing herself to the other people in the scene? Like, right. She needs everyone to believe she's good just so she can like have the biggest possible like effect on Bruce, because otherwise, you know, Lucius might be like, by the way, Miranda's actually Talia al Ghul. It's just one of those, because it's that thing where we talk about of like, is a character who's pretending not to be a villain. Are there moments where they're still acting like a bad guy when nobody else is around who would care. And it's like, well, no, I guess not, because she just needs everyone to believe so that like they'll all trust her. And it's like, okay, but it's like a lot of stuff gets pushed to the last 10 minutes of this movie.
Right. Well, and I feel like the twist reveal from her doesn't change anything. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like it's that the twist, it comes so late and it's made such a big deal has been made building up to this, and like, you know, the child that escaped and it was probably Bane, but twist, it was Miranda and she's the daughter of, and so like we're interrupting, you know, there's minutes left before Gotham explodes to give this exposition backstory of this twist that then doesn't blow it up. So the buildup there is like, okay, well, so she's still foiled, but also, as she says, you've bought Gotham 11 minutes. Like, it doesn't even delay. I don't know. It's just such a
right,
unsatisfying
that was
like, sequence of events.
Yeah.
Where, yeah.
Like, why why was she even going to bother pressing the button at that point? Like, you right. could just say, let's sit here together and watch Gotham blow up, because it's going to blow up immediately after this moment. But
And then that means that everything she's saying up to that moment was like her perfect idea of like how this would all end. And guess, it's kind of weird. And she doesn't say bye to Bane, but she says bye later when she, I don't know. It's all
also like, does having sex with Bruce Wayne like actually help her plan at all? Or is that just for fun?
I feel like that's the only scene I've skipped in a movie in a long time.
Yeah.
Where when I was rewatching and I was like, oh, this dumb scene, skip.
I do love that there's a Pete Holmes skit, which is really raunchy, but like where it's recreating that scene where she stabs him and everything. And she's like, I am Talia al Ghul. And then she just cuts her off. He's like, but we totally had sex. She's like, it was all part of the plan. He's like, yeah, but we did it like three times.
I can't watch the original scene without that skit.
Right. Exactly. It's
just totally replaced it.
Yeah. It was interesting leading up to this movie, though. I was talking to a friend and I think they started casting some of the actors in it. And I was like, I would love to see, and I think I talked about this on our Gone Girl podcast, it was like, I would love to see a female Joker-esque performance, not just like the same performance, but like something as powerful and like unbridled and like totally just fearless and off the rails. And I was thinking like the female villains we've had in movies tend to be sort of like quiet and powerful and sometimes like sexy and that kind of thing. And it's, you know, Cersei Lannister, that kind of thing, where it's just like, it's this very like calculated kind of character. And that works really well. I want to see like the Nolan version of a Harley Quinn, for instance. And I think Margot Robbie is a really cool Harley Quinn. I loved Birds of Prey, but it's not the same thing I'm talking about. And I was like thinking about who have I seen do anything close to this? And I think kind of Rosamund Pike in Gone Girl, kind of Kathy Bates in Misery, Helena Bonham Carter maybe is like Bellatrix Lestrange, you know, just that sort of like totally like bonkers, fearless kind of thing. And, you know, like Michelle Pfeiffer as Catwoman is great, but it's still that sort of like, you know, I'm playing a comic book villain kind of performance. So then my friend said, well, Ra's al Ghul has a daughter named Talia. And I was like, oh, that's cool. That would be a really cool thing. And then, of course, you could have done like Joker is dead, but he had a protege named Harley Quinn. And that would have felt like a little too obvious for a third movie, especially because then it would have been like trying too hard to be Dark Knight. And then the irony is like, for how much I wanted that, what we ended up getting in this movie is like two female villains, but like also kind of zero. Because you have Anne Hathaway as Catwoman, who like in the first, and I love her performance. I like that she sort of is kind of like Gone Girl. It's like she is willing to do whatever the moment needs. Like when she starts screaming when the cops show up at that place, like her performance is so good. And then she just sort of like looks and then goes. And you never know when she does her little like switch to Bruce. Oops, I didn't know it was uncrackable.
I love that moment.
Yeah, like I really do like her performance. But then pretty quickly, it's like, oh, no, she's going to be a good guy in this movie. So she's not really a villain. And then you have Miranda, who's just sort of there for a lot of the movie until, again, the last 5 minutes where it's like, no, I've been a bad guy all along. And it's like, oh, that's cool. But you're Marion Cotillard and you are an awesome actor and you're not really doing anything in this movie until the last 5 minutes where you reveal you were the bad guy all along. So I just think it's like a weird thing that like I got my wish times two, but also times zero, because like we don't actually get either of these two actors to give like the performance that they could have given if they were like a capital V villain in a Nolan Batman movie.
Yeah, kind of as you were describing that, I was just thinking, I kind of wish that Bane and Talia had been one character, and that had been Talia al Ghul, and have the reveal in the middle of the movie, like when Batman gets his back broken, like, you know, just have Bane be a, you know, a just strong, right? Mm-hmm. Like, don't try to make him a character, right? Just like a henchman for her. And then, like, if she betrayed Bruce then, right, and takes over the city, and then she's the main big bad for the final half of the movie,
right?
You know, like, I think.
Yeah. And I had a similar thought about the whole Gotham Under Siege thing, which was, what if this were a movie where the opening sequence, where it doesn't have to be at a football stadium, but what if the opening sequence were Bane with the bomb telling everyone they're screwed, and then we spend the entire movie like that? Like, I just felt there's a lot of stuff they could have like skipped forward to a lot of moments in this movie, like you're talking about, Sage, and then there, we could have like actually lived in that space for 2 hours rather than waiting so long to reveal so many of these things that by the time they happen you feel exhausted because there's already been so much story up to this point.
And Batman just constantly feels like he's chasing the plot, like like the plot is always 5 feet away from where Batman just got to. Like,
right.
So. It's a really good point. Yeah. I want the Sage rewrite of this movie. I'm sold.
Yeah.
I like all your changes. Yeah.
Thank you.
Having the ticking time bomb be there from the beginning, I feel like it'd be a different kind of mechanism where it's not as much, you know, I guess at the end, there's still the race to stop everything. But rather than introduce the bomb and then fast forward 5 months and like things are still fine, I feel like that immediately takes some of the scariness out of it. Even though they say it's, you know, it's just going to be here. I don't know. Introducing a bomb, it's going to go off sometime and we should be scared. And then we jump ahead 5 months and everything is still fine. Makes me just like, in a meta way, not worried about what's happening.
And like, we're going to drive the bomb around constantly for 5 months. We're going to have decoy trucks constantly for 5 months. Like, it's just,
it's like a video game.
Like the mechanics of the plan are just so convoluted. I don't know. I think you mentioned, Brian, how there's that interesting like meta trilogy, you know, those pairings of Batman Begins and Prestige and Dark Knight and Inception. I do think there is a similar kind of weirdly like early draft feeling to the screenplays for Dark Knight Rises and Interstellar. And it reminds me of like when I do an early draft of a script where it's like, I know I need a lot of things to happen. I have these sequences in mind that really excite me and I want to get to these points, but my first thought of how to get there is usually not the best thought. So like in an early draft of a script, oftentimes I'll find myself straining to get the characters to where I need them to be or to do a certain action. Like it's like they wouldn't naturally do this. I got to kind of force them to in a strained way. And I think a lot of the plot machinations of both Dark Knight Rises and Interstellar feel like that early draft version of a story where it's like we need somehow for Cooper to get Murph the like gravity information for her gravity equation, so we're going to make a ghost, she's a ghost as a kid and he can go through time and like he's going to program using Morse code, which she learned as a kid. Basically, I think there's probably a much simpler and more elegant and more interesting way to tell the same story Interstellar was trying to tell and Dark Knight Rises was trying to tell. And this seems like the early draft before you get lots of feedback and completely rewrite your movie to tell the story in that clearer, more elegant way. So I wonder if there's also just a side effect of Christopher Nolan being so wildly, wildly successful, being so revered, was nobody giving him as much feedback or telling him no or making suggestions anymore.
Yeah, I mean, any filmmaker who is known for a certain style ultimately gets to a point where they just do like the biggest thing they can, you know, your Tim Burton's, your Wes Anderson's, that kind of thing, where it's just like, now I'm doing so much of the thing. And some people love it. And some people are just like, I liked when it was sort of measured and not just full on, you know, Tarantino.
And I do feel like in some ways, his hands were a little bit tied there, because I think what is left to do again after The Dark Knight? I mean, I think you could do a better version of this, but there is just all those extra pressures and the mounting expectations, and you've lost the Joker. So like that's, you know, that the most powerful thing from your previous movie is no longer an option.
Also, like, I think, like, I can forgive the first draft-itis that this movie feels like it's having, because, like, The Dark Knight came out in 2008, Inception came out in 2010, and then this movie comes out in 2012. Like, that's insane. Like, that that's crazy to be dealing with movies of this scale, like, that frequently.
It makes sense that it eventually would happen, that you would just wouldn't have enough time to give the writing, like, you know, the maybe the years of stewing that it might need to become the perfect version of itself.
Right.
And I do think, as you were saying, Sage, that kind of conflating some of these characters would be a good solution.
Yep.
And when I was watching the film, I was feeling that, like, God, there's a lot of people. I kind of attributed it to this feeling of, like, it feels like Inception is kind of leaking into this movie because of the actors that have, like, carried over. And it feels like they all, like, needed to have, like, screen time and do things because, like, maybe Nolan just really loved them and they are all really great actors. It created all these little mini plots and threads that didn't add up and didn't feel like they were all unified in what they were trying to do at all points. And that was a frustrating experience.
Yeah. And, like, once you've invested a certain amount of time in a character, like, they have to be part of the ending too. Right.
Right.
So they have to, it has to pay off some way. And I think the person who draws the short end of the stick here is Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character, because, you know, everyone else is dealing with the main plot and then he's, like, stuck on a bridge for, like, 10 minutes and it has no impact on anything. But he's, you got to keep cutting back to him because, like, the audience, like, he's, like, the main guy now. Like,
right.
You know, so.
You should use your real name. It's Robin. Let me hand you a card with my real name on it because I can't just say it out loud because we need the other character to say it. By the way, you know whose real name isn't Robin? Robin.
It's the Nolan universe version. I know. Yeah. I liked that moment.
In your other podcast, you guys were talking about, like, the dumb, bad extras dialogue in some of the other movies.
Yeah.
Boy, you are in for a show tonight, son.
Yep. They crank it up to 11 on this movie.
Like, yes. A rat in a maze.
Yeah.
I think you got the wrong animal there, sir. and then Catwoman, like effing off, and then, you know, Batman goes, so that's what that feels like.
Like, in the Batman voice, yes. To himself.
It's like what you were saying, Brian, like, when you're a villain who's in disguise, you shouldn't, like, still be pretending when you're by yourself. Right. Like, why does Batman still talk like that to himself? That doesn't make any sense.
Right. Robin asks Bruce Wayne in, like, a scene that's, like, 2 seconds long, like, why do you wear the mask? And he says, to protect the people closest to me. And then Robin says, yeah, but you were, like, a loner. You didn't have any family. Who says that?
Right. Also, like, we don't need to talk about, like, I know you're Batman because I, too, am an orphan.
Right. That was pretty
that
quick.
Was a stretch.
I saw the orphan look in your eyes and therefore knew you were Batman.
But, like, JGL is so good that, like, I buy it. I was willing to go with it. And in general, I like what they were doing with Robin. And I feel like by not calling him that, it like, I don't know, it lessens it. Like, either never say his name or just let us know that it's Robin and, like, have the fun of, like, seeing that kind of origin story happening. Mm-hmm.
But we have, like, Batman Beyond. Like, we have stories where there is a new person named Batman, like, under the title of Batman, who becomes Batman. So, like, why say his name is Robin if the idea is he becomes, like, I would watch a Joseph Gordon-Levitt Nightwing movie or Robin movie, like, to death, but to say he's Robin, but he's going to kind of be the new Batman, I guess, ? That's Terry McGinnis and Batman Beyond. Like, it's like, if you're going to call attention to this thing that is not established at all in the Nolan trilogy, but is sort of a Batman thing, then you have to make it make some sort of sense if you're going to explain it all in one line. Like, your name is Robin, which is not the name of Robin, but you're going to be the new Batman, I guess, ? Like, it's just, it's too much.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't mind it. I thought it was kind of like a cute, I mean, by that point in the movie, I was just happy to have, like, that ending. So I think it was, to me, it was more just like a cute nod, more than, like, trying to do anything in particular. And I liked the idea of JGL being the successor Batman. I wish.
Sure.
I want that Batman movie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. As you were pointing out, Sage, he gets the short end of the stick at the end, where so much work is put into seeing him kind of go on this journey to become kind of like Batman. And we have like a mini moment with him where he sort of independently decides he doesn't like guns either, where he's like going and checking out the cement people. And then he like accidentally shoots like a tanker behind, and the bullet ricochets and happens to kill the guy. So right. Like he didn't mean to kill the guy, but he still did. And immediately he just throws his gun away because he's just like, no guns ever again.
Yeah.
But it's still fun to like see that evolution happen, and like his relationship with Jim Gordon, I think, is kind of cool. Mm-hmm. That, like that develops. Mm-hmm. So that then to get to the finale and have Batman, like he's like, what should I do? And Batman's like, go tell, we need to get some people out. So go tell some people that we're leaving, and then get like, tell these kids to go knock on doors, but then get the other kids on the bus and then ride the bus to the bridge, and then try to talk everybody out of the thing that they've not let anyone do for 5 months. Yeah. And then again, like you're saying, Sage, it doesn't affect anything whatsoever. Like he might as well not be in the movie after that point.
I mean, I think it was supposed to be like saying this was his last straw with like being a police officer. Like those cops are just following orders. I'm going to be Batman now. You know, I think that's the dramatic function of it, but it doesn't play that way as you're watching it.
Yeah.
I feel like that's what it's doing, but like that doesn't track. The law, like not letting people stop the bad guys, is not the problem in this movie, right? Like that was the problem in the other movies.
Right. There's that thematic disconnection where it's like, as we were saying earlier, the whole point is like, in the end, the police save the day, and the one blonde policeman guy is like, there's only one police in this town, and then, you know, is in his...
Oh, that's maybe the most cringy moment of the whole thing, when they're... That dude, of all people, to, like, give, like, a redemption story to, like, I don't care about his redemption story.
Right.
Like,
Too many characters.
You look weirdly like Aaron Eckhart. It's confusing. Joseph Gordon-Levitt looks like Heath Ledger. It's confusing. There's too much.
Yeah, and then like the scene where like Gordon goes to like recruit him again for like, the final push, it's like, does anybody care to be in this scene right now?
Right.
Like, you know what I mean?
Like, and then when he dies in the most like, position your body as if you like to make a hilarious looking chalk outline later.
Right. No blood, just like, just taking a rest here.
Right.
You know? Not even the worst death in this movie, though.
Okay, yeah, poor Talia.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a weird little thingy she does.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I thought it was fine.
Really? It's pretty bad.
It's like right at the end, it just feels like kind of like forced, right? Yeah. Like she kind of like, there's a little, like, I'm dead now, you know?
Right. It's that very last exhalation. Yeah. That's just like, meow.
Maybe at that point, I'm just so paying attention to so many other things. Like there's like 90 seconds left on this bomb. Right. Like we don't have time.
See, that's to make out with Catwoman.
That's the thing with Christopher Nolan movies, is anytime you notice a problem, then he like tag teams with Hans Zimmer, and Hans Zimmer just pummels you in the face 15 times.
Yeah.
And you forget about everything.
Hans Zimmer does a lot of work in this movie.
Absolutely.
Every time the Batman theme shows up, like when Batman is Batman again, like an hour in, I'm just like, okay, I know I'm watching this movie, but oh, damn, I'm excited right now.
It works. It always works.
And I feel like the score, I mean, to go back to, again, I think the best part of the movie, the Batman Rising, and just like that chant that everyone is doing, like that's legitimately like really, really cool, and like pumps me up. And I feel like we get a glimpse in that moment of what it's like when all the things in a Christopher Nolan film are working together, where it's like the sound and the music and the theme and the action is just like, I'm completely here for this moment, and it's delivering it, and it's so, so great.
And it's a sequence entirely in IMAX. It's not cutting between IMAX and
between
non-IMAX
aspect ratios. Yeah.
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I was like angry that you guys talked about aspect ratio in your last podcast. This is the podcast to be angry about it.
I don't even care by this movie. I'm just like expecting it now.
Well, because he did in Dark Knight. There were a couple moments where maybe it switched aspect ratios mid sequence, but he pretty much was like, for this scene, we are in IMAX, and that is what works for me, is when he commits to the sequence is an IMAX sequence, and you're gonna just kind of feel like a special thing's happening now. But for both the Rises and for Interstellar, it's like all over the place.
The worst example, I think, in this movie is when Bane is giving a speech, and when you're watching him, it's all IMAX. but then they're cross-cutting to Gordon watching it on TV, and it's not IMAX in his apartment. So it's just like the bars are coming in up and up.
Right. Like, and at that point, it's like there's a weird commitment to like everything we got in IMAX, we're going to show you in IMAX, goddammit. But it's it's like, well, but if it's going to really be distracting and actually calling my attention constantly to the aspect ratio, maybe don't. Like, maybe it's okay. Yeah, you got it in IMAX, but then you recut it later. You didn't mean for it to be in this order. That's okay. Just put the bars on. It's like, it's
it almost fine. Feels like a video game cutting to a cutscene at some points. Because like in the finale, there it's IMAX when they're outside, and then like he punches Bane into the building, and then,
right,
and
right.
then it cuts. Yeah, so it's like now we're into the.
It's a video game. Yeah,
right, right.
It feels like a video game cutscene.
And it's like, why would you go down? Like at that moment, you're building up to like Batman just like he's gotten the upper hand on Bane finally, and now we're gonna see this like climactic moment. I think that adds to that video gamey cutscene feel where it's suddenly like, oh, I don't need to pay as much attention now because like,
yeah, yeah, it totally winds this. You down. Like if you're tuned into that sort of thing, like you're like, oh, this is like after the action, you know, like we're done.
Yeah. Well, one thing that is always good in Christopher Nolan movies is Michael Caine, and he continues to be very good in this movie. I just wanted to.
He says, every summer I go to Florence and I get so shit faced of Fede Breaker that I think I see you, but it turns out to just be some other asshole in a jumper.
You guys said his impressions were bad. Those were like, that's like.
No, Brian said they were bad.
He says, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think they're fantastic.
They're spot on. Yeah.
They're fun.
That setup that he does makes for like a fun ending,
yeah,
but it is also so specific,
right?
Like it's like, while you've been gone these last 8 years, I would do this like annual trip for myself. I would take myself over here and I'd always sit in the same cafe and I'd kind of just look around hoping you were there. And it's like, it's so specific, and obviously it has to be because that's exactly what happens at the end.
Sure.
But it calls attention to itself because it's so specific in a way that is kind of disappointing.
This is what you write in your first draft because you know you want the ending and you just set it up and you haven't figured it out yet. So you just put in the simple shortcut until you get the feedback and figure it out later.
Right.
Right. Right. But three drafts later, he's saying it to a different character as just like an offhand thing. Right.
Right. And then, I mean, I think it's partially, it's not like he's actually literally expecting him to be at that cafe in Florence. It's more just he's sharing his fantasy. But then once he shares his fantasy, Bruce is like, I'll go do that exact thing and give you a little nod. And then Anne Hathaway will turn sideways at the exact moment so we can see her in profile too. You know,
right.
I think I enjoy it.
I like all of it. Like, I like what it accomplishes. Like, I like the ending a lot.
Yeah.
The Christopher Nolan endings when he's like cross-cutting like five different stories together and they're all hitting their climaxes. And it's, you know, like, yeah, that hits really well.
If you want to hear our thoughts on the Nolan crosscut, go to YouTube today, the day that this releases, I think.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. If all is going according to plan.
Yeah. It's all part of the plan.
So the Lord of the Rings movies came out when I was in high school, and they were an obsession of mine and kind of changed who I was as a filmmaker. I want to talk about the different cuts. I personally think they should make a master cut with the best of the theatrical and extended, because I have problems with both.
Is there a cut without Orlando Bloom?
What's wrong with Orlando Bloom?
He's an elf. Elves are cool. I'd be an elf.
Anyway, if you want to hear us talk more about Lord of the Rings, we are actually going to be doing a three-part series for the podcast when we reach 500 patrons on Patreon. So if you want that to happen, go ahead and go to patreon.com, find Beyond the Screenplay, and support us. We will also be doing a Patreon-exclusive episode about the Hobbit trilogy, which is going to be interesting. We hope to see you on Patreon. Just a couple bucks a month really helps support the channel and keeps us going.
Subscribe, you fools.
Brian.
All right. Well, why don't we, trying to end on maybe a positive note, go around and say what lessons we're going to take from The Dark Knight Rises. There's no guarantee this will be positive, but let's give it a try. Brian, do you want to start us off? We'll end with you, Sage. We'll save the best for last.
Oh, stop.
It's not terribly positive. It's basically just know your limits. You know, and I think, like, again, just following what Nolan was able
Batman
to do.
Batman has no limits.
But Christopher Nolan does.
But you do, Chris.
I think that's the lesson of this podcast right here. Like the thesis statement.
No, I mean, I really don't have much more to say than that, other than just like we've seen so many things that just feel bloated. They feel like they go on too long, and they feel like they have a lot of great ideas, but instead of culling the ideas that maybe aren't important to the central theme, or maybe are too fringed, to, you know, not quite focused enough, you just end up getting this thing that just feels like it's too much. And as you guys talked about with the last season of Game of Thrones, there's that sort of feeling of, look, none of your ideas are bad. It's just the execution and how quickly you tried to get to all these big things that you're trying to shove so many things together. So again, this could have been two incredible movies, but it was one very long, very fast paced, very convoluted movie. And I think as we said at the beginning, it's just a case of someone biting off more than they can chew. And, you know, I would rather watch a drama with two people in a room for an hour and a half, if it feels like focused and impressive and like the filmmaker knew exactly what they were doing, than the biggest, most ambitious movie in the world, if it just feels messy and like I'm like not invested in it by the time it's over.
Word. Alex?
I have a positive lesson.
Okay.
We already touched on this, and the pinnacle of it is what you were saying, Michael, is that rise sequence, you know, where it's that resurrection kind of archetypal story. Basically, I think when this movie shines, it's when Nolan kind of falls back into that more archetypal mythic realm, where it's not about the convoluted plot that doesn't really make sense, or all the timelines that don't match up, or, you know, what is Bane's plan and why is it, like, why? it's really about like this hero's journey and creating really evocative images and music and sound and putting it all together to give you just kind of that kind of pure cinema experience. And I think there are some moments in this movie that still do that. And those moments are simple. You know, that moment is simple. It's about Bruce Wayne deciding he wants to live. And that is what I remember about this movie. That's the sequence that gives me shivers and goosebumps and makes me like excited again. And I think the lesson is that's really what we go to the movies for, is for those like deeper archetypal emotions that kind of only cinema can give us with visuals and sound and music all at once. And Nolan is great at that. And I think my lesson to him is, yeah, like you can ditch some of the convoluted plot. We don't really care. We can't really follow it. Who cares? Just like strip it down to that core, because that's why we come to see your movies. Ultimately.
Yeah, I think that is a good lesson. It's a good takeaway, and that sequence is so simple and it's focused on this one thing. And it's like we were saying, there's the thematic level of it, but just the simple action of it is extremely compelling also, where you have to make this impossible jump. You've tried it twice, you've failed, you have to do it without the rope, like the stakes are increasing, like everything is happening in this nice little, yeah, contained story. And there's kind of this like irony to it also, like to prove that you want to live, you have to risk death. I don't know. There's just something about that moment that I think really is special. I want to say that for Nolan. Like, he did that really well.
And I would say in that archetypal realm, I think the characters that really work, like I think Anne Hathaway's Catwoman is a great like rebel character. Like, mm-hmm. like you really mm-hmm. enjoy being with her, especially in that first half of the film when she kind of has some things to do, because she is like, she is screwing with the system and impersonating a maid and, you know, capturing the senator or whatever, like she's like Jester who's like screwing with things. That's once again like a simple archetypal type of character. It's not like when Bane does things in this like kind of socio-political way, it's not tracking, because like what is Bane's archetype? Is he the strong man? Is he like the muscle, like, or is he this like kind of like weird like lefty academic thinker who like wants to like have a revolution? Like what is he?
Yeah.
And that's when it doesn't work. There's no like cohesion there.
Yeah. So just quickly, my lesson, I guess, is all of that. But I think also just as a filmmaker and in this meta way, as like for us as consumers of film, I feel like I like to give filmmakers the benefit of the doubt also when they are going up, when you're J.J. Abrams and halfway through production, things get halted, and then it's like your job is to now come in and save this movie and also end this franchise in this perfect way, and it is an impossible task, now go do it, and only if somehow you make it perfect will people love you, otherwise you are a failure. And I think we're very hard on our storytellers sometimes, and I think this is a really good example of that, where he did bite off more than he could chew, but I also think it's really cool that he decided to like go for it and be bold in different ways and not just try to remake The Dark Knight. He didn't go backward in any way, and maybe that could have made for a better movie, but that might have been disappointing also in different ways. So I feel like you're just kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place, and what do you do? And so
I mean, the only reason this movie is frustrating is because there is so many moments of brilliance like woven into it, and like everyone involved is like, you know, on the top of their game, like incredible artists. You know, it just didn't come together probably in the way that they wanted it to, or that, you know, there was not enough time or 100 other considerations. So it's, you know, it's you look at the movie and you see what could have been, and that's what you end up comparing it to.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Well said. Sage, what's your lesson? What's your takeaway?
So mine was about Alfred. So there's a moment in this movie where Alfred says, if you don't listen to me, I'm going to leave. And then he does. And he does not come back until like the last 5 minutes of the movie. And I've always really loved this because the movie isn't afraid to like not resolve a conflict between characters. I feel like there's a lot of movies where a lot of the interpersonal conflicts are very small and they get resolved too quickly. And like, you know, they argue, but then like a scene later, you know, they realize they're not, you know, the other person wasn't so bad after all. Right. And then it's like really easily resolved. So like Alfred like really wants to make a point. And I think like that decision I've always really admired. So yeah, that'd be the lesson.
That's always a memorable scene for me, and how he's just like, I have nothing left to stop you. This is my one weapon, is to like leave for forever. And then he does. Yeah. Again, I want to see an Alfred movie that explains what he was doing and what he gets up to on his like annual trips to Florence or wherever he is.
His catching jewel thief days.
Right.
Yeah. I drink drinks in Florence, and then I go to Berber and burn shit down.
Oh, there's a Batman comic where Alfred is like a veteran. Forgetting the name of it now, but
awesome. Well, why don't we quickly go around and say what we've been watching recently. Alex, what have you been watching?
I checked out the first episode of Lovecraft Country on HBO. Now HBO Max, I guess. I think they're forcing everybody onto the Max, and it's based on a novel. The show is developed by Misha Green, and it's kind of following in the footsteps of the Watchmen HBO series, where trying to use genre to explore the history of race in America, and like very explicitly it takes place in like segregated South, like in a time period when it was actually like some of the horror for the characters is like, is it safe to go on a road trip across the country, or might we die depending on where we are geographically. So it's a really interesting pilot because it doesn't get to the Lovecraftian supernatural elements until pretty late in the pilot. The first half or the first three quarters is really more of like a period piece. And it was interesting. I'm looking forward to seeing where it goes. I think it's a tricky thing to try to do all these things at once, to do like a fantasy horror genre piece, also very like explicitly like a political and kind of historical piece about race. Like I see a lot of creators trying to tackle these things all at once, and I think it's admirable and interesting to try to use genre as a lens for these difficult issues, because you might reach more people through genre. But it's a tricky balancing act of how do you make a piece feel of a whole while doing so much at once. And I did find myself not really knowing what the show was until like the very last scene of the pilot. It's based on a novel though, so maybe it just takes a pilot to get to the inciting incident. So I'm gonna keep watching and see where it goes, but it's definitely worth checking out. It's just part of this new generation I'm seeing of like genre exploring race. So check it out.
Cool. Yeah.
Nice. Brian, what have you been watching?
I finally got around to watching the third season of Ozark on Netflix, which I am a big fan of the show. I think it's really well done, very Breaking Bad in its tone, and the fact that it'll do things where you're like, oh shit, they went there. Okay, I did not see that coming. Jason Bateman is like one of the, I'm looking at my notes and I wrote Jason Batman. Jason Bateman is, you know, obviously one of the stars and is one of the main directors of the show, and he does a phenomenal job. Laura Linney is outstanding. I didn't know she was in the show. The very first thing I saw was a friend of mine on Facebook who said, like, Ozark's the best movie, best show I've seen since Breaking Bad. And I was like, cool. And I saw on Netflix, the picture was just like Jason Bateman looking beat to shit. And I was like, I'm just going to go watch the first episode. I don't know what this is. I'm just going to put it on without looking up anything about it. And then 5-10 minutes in, Laura Linney shows up as his wife. And I'm like, okay, I'm totally on board with this. She gets to be like really scary and really badass this season. And her character is really interesting. And then one of the other main characters is played by Julia Garner, who is also fantastic. And I'm guessing, kind of like Breaking Bad, where Jesse was supposed to die in the first season, but they were like, Aaron Paul's so good, we have to make Jesse a main character. Julia Garner is so good that I have to imagine that after the first season, they were like, no, she needs to be a huge character on the show because she's just too good. And I really like Ozark. Speaking of, sometimes characters do things that are a little convenient for the writing. It's a little guilty of that sometimes, but you kind of get over it because of how good everything else is. But it's definitely a show where you can watch the first episode and know 100% if it's for you or not, because it's one of those shows that just gets right to it.
Sounds great. I've had a lot of people recommend it to me, and I've been holding off because it's like, do I want to do a Breaking Bad show right now? But it sounds like universally beloved by everybody who's seen it. So
cool. Sage, what have you been watching?
So I've been having like a hell of a time building up any kind of desire to watch things I haven't already seen in quarantine, at least. Like, it's I read an article about, like, you know, when things are uncertain in the world, that like watching a story where you actually know what already happens, like, brings a sense of certainty. So I haven't really been watching, like, unless it's work related, I have not been watching like new media, which is kind of unfortunate. But I guess that's all a prologue to say that I've been rewatching Dexter, of all things. If anyone hasn't seen Dexter, watch the first 4 seasons and then stop. It's really just an excellent thriller, really kind of white knuckle viewing. So
nice. Yeah, Dexter was like a weird journey for me, because it's a kind of TV show that I hadn't seen in a while, but it is also really compelling, and the sort of where it goes is fun. And, you know, psychopath killer as your protagonist is always an interesting thing to play with.
Yeah. If you've watched Death Note or Mr. Robot, it's pretty much the exact same show.
Like, it's interesting. Cool. A couple weeks ago, I watched the Hulu feature film Palm Springs with Andy Samberg and Kristen Milioti. And it was really, really fun. It's a time loop movie. It's like Groundhog Day, but it takes that concept and kind of plays with it and plays with the kind of romantic comedy genre in interesting ways. And I thought it was a cool entry in the log of evolutions of Groundhog Day movies. And I feel like some movies, like I was saying about like The Dark Knight, is greater than the sum of its parts, right? Like, its parts are really good, but the final thing is just somehow magic. I feel like Palm Springs is like exactly the sum of its parts. And I think sometimes those are the best films to look at and study, because it means, you know, those things are more repeatable. It doesn't require some magic lightning in a bottle to come and happen. Casting Kristen Milioti always helps also. That's probably the most magic that helps it. But yeah, I thought it was really, really fun and an interesting film to look at if you're thinking about time loops and how it evolves that concept.
Patrick already beat us to that video.
I know.
That's Patrick Willems.
We need to all have, like, we need to meet up and be like, okay, you're going to do this topic and you're going to do this topic.
Yeah. The heads of the 5 families need to get together.
Right. Awesome. Well, this has been our conversation on The Dark Knight Rises. Thank you so much, Sage, for joining us. Can't wait to have you back. A lot of fun. Check out his channel, Just Right, WRITE. You will love it, I'm sure. Thank you to the patrons for supporting this channel, and thank you for listening. We will see you in the next episode.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Take care.